it's a great opportunity for them to make sure that their communities and their region's voice is heard.
Regional subsistence advisory councils are having trouble filling positions. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 30th of December. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, changes are coming for the North Pacific Groundfish and Halibut Observer programs.
Vessel selection was not working very well. So the change is that we're going to treat all of those vessels just like we treat the bigger trip selection vessels, because that worked very well.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Over the years, Alaskans like you have donated over $10 million to nonprofit organizations benefiting everything from Alaska's youth to the arts to health care. You've even donated to public radio to keep quality programming alive and well in Alaska. So come on, Alaska, warm your heart by sharing your PFD. Pick, click, give. This message on Alaska Public Media comes from ExxonMobil.
Governor Bill Walker has made his final decision on his administration and education commissioner. Walker has named Sheldon Fisher head of administration, a department with a wide range of government responsibilities, including overseeing the Division of Motor Vehicles, as well as the Alaska Public Offices Commission, or APOC. Fisher has been an executive at McKinley Capital Management since 2011. Before that, he led the sales and marketing team at Alaska Communications. Fisher also made a failed bid at public office in 2010 when he launched a primary challenge against Republican Congressman Don Young. Young took 70% of the vote. Walker, in concert with the Board of Education, has also reappointed Mike Hanley as a commissioner. Hanley was originally named Education Commissioner in 2011 by then-Governor Sean Parnell. Hanley is one of four cabinet members from the previous administration who will continue to serve under Walker. Before being named Education Commissioner, Hanley spent 20 years in the Anchorage School District, with six of those as a principal. All of Walker's commissioner appointments must be approved by the legislature this spring. Subsistence harvests are managed by federal agencies with input from local residents through regional advisory councils. But as KMBA's Jacqueline Estes reports, local residents aren't stepping up to be on the councils.
The Federal Office of Subsistence Management is seeking applicants for the 10 subsistence regional advisory councils that provide information and recommendations on fish and wildlife management proposals to the Federal Subsistence Board. Carl Johnson is the Council Coordination Division Chief in the Federal Office of Subsistence Management. He says the number of applicants to serve on the regional councils has been dropping over the years.
So far, we have only received about a dozen applications for 36 open seats on the 10 regional advisory councils. And historically, for the first 10 years of the program, we had a really good number of applications annually, averaging around 104. And for the last 10 years, we've seen about a 30% decline, with an average annual application number of about 70. And the last couple of years, it's continued the decline.
Johnson says reasons for the decline in applications aren't known, but he does want people to know that the regional councils have an important role in subsistence management on federal public lands. Except in limited circumstances, the Federal Subsistence Board is required to give deference to council input on fish and wildlife proposals. In recent years, Johnson says the board has adopted regional recommendations 90% of the time.
Most of the people who get on the regional advisory councils stay on them for a long period of time, because they realize that once they're on those councils, they have an opportunity to really meaningfully influence subsistence management. And, you know, it's a great opportunity for them to make sure that their communities and their region's voice is heard. And it's a really meaningful and rewarding experience, I think.
Johnson says council meetings do involve travel.
What the Federal Subsistence Management Program does is it pays for all airfare and lodging for the council members when they travel for their meetings. It also provides them a per diem to cover any food expenses or other expenses that they have while they're traveling. Typically, the council meetings are 2 days long, so we have them travel the day before the meeting and then go home the day after. So there's about 4 days total of travel, twice a year.
Applicants need to be knowledgeable about subsistence and other fish and wildlife uses in their area. The deadline for applications to serve on a Subsistence Regional Advisory Council is January 23rd. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
Both boys charged with chasing down a herd of muskox before killing several of the animals just outside of Brevik Mission have now reached a deal with state prosecutors, bringing to a close a case that started back in 2012. More than 2 years ago, the two boys, at the time aged 10 and 13, were charged with shooting at a small herd of the iconic animals with rifles and shotguns over the course of several days, before ultimately chasing the herd down on four-wheelers and killing seven of the animals, five cows and two bulls. The names of both of the boys involved with the incident are not being released due to their age. In all, the pair faced dozens of charges, including a combined 11 counts of wanton waste of big game when they first appeared before a Nome judge in January. The younger of the two boys faced seven charges of wanton waste of muskox, as well as eight misdemeanor hunting violations and tampering with evidence. Alaska statute calls for a $3,000 penalty for illegally killing a muskox. In a plea bargain this month, the younger boy reached a deal with prosecutors in exchange for a guilty plea to one consolidated charge of wanton waste. He was fined $500, with $500 suspended, and ordered to pay $3,000 in restitution to the state, just a fraction of the $21,000 fine he could have faced. The boy also has to forfeit his Yamaha four-wheeler and the four guns used in the muskox killing. In addition, the terms of the deal rescind the boy's hunting privileges for 1 year. In July, the older of the two boys reached a similar deal, pleading guilty to one count of wanton waste in exchange for a single $3,000 fine and the forfeiture of all equipment, including guns and four-wheelers used in the killing. In the deal reached with the older boy earlier this year, state prosecutors said many of the financial penalties and other punishments the boys faced were reduced due to their young age. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, North Pole residents will be wading into the new year for Salt Lake cleanup guidelines.
Currently, there is no estimate for when DEC will issue a final cleanup level for Salt Lake.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Four-time Yukon Quest champion Lance Mackey signed up yesterday for the 1,000-mile race between Whitehorse, Yukon Territory, and Fairbanks. The Fairbanks musher says the quest is in his backyard, and it's hard not to want to be part of it. Mackey will race against three other former champions, including Alan Moore, who has back-to-back titles the last 2 years. Former champions Hugh Neff and Jeff King are also part of the 28-team field. The Yukon Quest gets underway on February 7, 2015. A shooting death at the University of Alaska Fairbanks earlier this month has been ruled a suicide. 48-year-old student Scott Austin was found dead from a gunshot next to his car in a campus parking lot on the morning of December 3rd. Austin's death was initially suspected to be an accident, but UAF Police Chief Keith Mallard says an autopsy performed at the State Medical Examiner's Office found Austin's injury to be consistent with suicide.
This was further collaborated with a note that was left in his residence.
Austin from Fairbanks was a sophomore in the petroleum engineering program and had been enrolled since fall 2012 semester, according to UAF spokeswoman Miriam Grimes. Austin was an Air Force veteran, originally from New York. ...2015 will bring changes for the North Pacific Groundfish and Halibut Observer programs. The North The National Marine Fisheries Service held outreach meetings in Kodiak and Homer this month. Fishermen and NIMFS representatives discussed the North Pacific Groundfish and Halibut Observer Program. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver attended the meeting in Homer and has more on upcoming changes for 2015 and feedback from fishermen.
The overall feeling at the meeting seemed to be discontent with a grain of salt. Many fishermen who attended voiced their frustration with the Observer program in general, but many also said they understand what its purpose is. That sentiment is nothing new to Martin Lefled.
I'm with the Alaska Fishery Science Center based out of Seattle, and I'm the director of the Observer program in Alaska for the federal fisheries.
He says NIMFS has received a lot of feedback and it's listening.
So the council and NIMFS recognize that something wasn't working. The program has the flexibility to change, so we're changing it to the area that is working.
Lefled says the greatest change will be to the way observers are placed on partial coverage category vessels. Starting in 2015, observers will be placed when a vessel is selected through the Observer Declare and Deploy System, or ODS. In the past, large vessels with 100% coverage and vessels greater than 57.5 feet fishing with trawl gear or hook and line fixed gear fell under what is called trip selection. Vessels between 40 and 57.5 feet fishing with hook and line and pot gear were previously under vessel selection.
So vessel selection was not working very well. So the change is that we're going to treat all of those vessels just like we treat the bigger trip selection vessels, because that worked very well.
So all partial coverage category vessels that use trawl gear or are greater than or equal to 40 feet and use hook and line or pot gear will be in the trip selection pool. Vessel owners and operators will be required to log each fishing trip onto ODS at least 72 hours before departure. Then they'll be immediately notified if the trip has been randomly selected. If chosen, a NIMFS contractor will provide the observer.
And that's going to fix the problem where previously they were being selected for a 2-month period. So the burden was very great. So we think we've made it more workable for the fleet, so the impact of the observer coverage is going to be for just that trip that's been picked. Relatively low rate, so not that many trips will be picked. It'll still be a burden, but just for a trip. And I think everyone can deal with a trip.
Some vessels will not be chosen. The no selection pool comprises vessels fishing with hook and line gear or pot gear that are less than 40 feet. All catcher vessels of any length with jig, handline, troll, and dingle bar troll gear, and vessels that are conditionally released due to life raft capacity. Additionally, starting in 2015, vessels voluntarily participating in NIMFS electronic monitoring study will not be selected. Malcolm Milne works with the North Pacific Fisheries Association. His group has been involved with testing and designing what he calls a reasonable and applicable electronic monitoring system. He says EM could be a more economical alternative to a physical observer.
The numbers are all over the board, but it's something like $1,000 a day for an observer on a boat. That's what it's costing the program, and we're trying to get a system where we can bring those costs down and therefore provide more coverage across all the fisheries.
Milne says he doesn't foresee EM replacing observers anytime soon, but he says the program has potential.
It's still in its development phase, I mean, that's for sure, but there's been a lot of cooperation and a lot of frustration between the industry and National Marine Fisheries Service between, you know, getting the program running and what the goal should be and in which direction we should be going with it, so it's a ways off.
The idea of taking a camera instead of a live observer seemed to go over well with many fishermen in the room, but they still had questions about other facets of the program. A few voiced concerns about an observer bumping an IFQ holder off a trip if there's not enough room to carry both. Others worried that some observers don't communicate enough with crews and write down complaints that they say aren't entirely valid. Chris Cease of the Katrina M had a suggestion for the program. Allow tenders to transport observers on and off boats so they don't have to be picked up on the docks.
Where if the tenders could bring them to the grounds, we deliver to the tender, they get on our boat, we do a trip, they get back on the tender, they go back to town, or they get on the other boat that's coming to deliver.
He thinks it would streamline the process, cause less hassle for some boats, and even out the playing field for others. He says it would be in the best interest of the program.
And if they want to get their 24% coverage, this is huge in my mind, because say I got selected for trip two for an observer. Well, I leave on trip one. I just don't go back to town. I deliver to a tender all winter. technically I do one trip all winter, but I make 25 deliveries. So I'm never going to have to take that observer because I never go to town.
Martin Lefled says the council and nymphs are discussing the tender issue and are taking other concerns into consideration as well. But big changes will only come after thorough research.
We want to make sure that the science has integrity.
So he asks fishermen to work with the program for another year as it develops more throughout 2015. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
The dispute over a cleanup standard for sulfalane-contaminated groundwater in the community of North Pole will likely continue into the new year. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, state regulators are still reviewing toxicity studies to determine a safe cleanup level for the chemical solvent traced to historic spills at a North Pole oil refinery.
Officials with the State Department of Environmental Conservation suggested last fall that DEC Commissioner Larry Hartig may issue a decision on a cleanup level for groundwater contaminated with the industrial solvent sulfalane around the end of the year. But DEC Environmental Program Manager Bill O'Connell says that's unlikely to happen.
Currently, there is no estimate for when DEC will issue a final cleanup level for sulfalane.
It's a complex issue, made even more so because there's no accepted standard for how much sulfalane a human can be exposed to before it poses a threat to health. O'Connell says DEC officials are continuing their analysis of data as part of a review of a DEC staff recommendation for a stringent cleanup level of 14 parts per billion. Hartig agreed to the review in April in response to a request by Flint Hills Resources Alaska. Flint Hills owns the North Pole refinery that leaked sulfalane into the groundwater, apparently before it bought the facility in 2004. Flint Hills officials suggested a year ago that DEC should instead set a less stringent cleanup level that would allow 25 times more sulfalane than the agency's recommendation. O'Connell says much of the data the DEC is still weighing on the subject was presented during a two-day session in September by a panel of experts the DEC asked to look into the issue. The experts with Ohio-based Toxicology Excellence for Risk Assessment, or TERRA, focused on studies on reference doses for sulfalane. That refers to the maximum amount of a toxic substance that can be ingested before it poses a risk to human health.
Those discussions were in regards to the reference dose, which is one factor of a number of factors that go into calculating a cleanup level for sulfalane.
O'Connell says a report on the 2 days of discussion have been posted to the TERRA website. Reporting from Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska state troopers are seeking the public's help in a search for a 72-year-old Wisconsin man who disappeared in August. Troopers say Roger Yeager of Eagle River, Wisconsin, traveled to Alaska over the summer to view wildlife. Family members last heard from Yeager on August 8th when he visited a relative in Wasilla. Troopers traced Yeager's subsequent travel to Fairbanks, where he turned in his rental car a day or two after his Wasilla visit. Troopers were contacted a few weeks ago by relatives who said Yeager didn't return emails for an extended period of time. According to troopers, Yeager had told relatives he was going to travel around Alaska and would update them around Christmas. Troopers say there is no record of Yeager flying in Alaska or leaving the state.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
It will cost passengers more to ride the state ferry starting in the summer. That's when fares for most Alaska Marine Highways will increase by 4.5%. According to the Department of Transportation, tickets booked after the first of the year for travel after May 1st will reflect the new rates. Tickets booked before the new year will fall under the current rates. The new fare structure is spurred by the recommendations of a recent rate analysis. The Marine Transportation Advisory Board saw the preliminary recommendations of that report during a recent meeting in Ketchikan. DOT spokesman Jeremy Woodrow says the department was planning to raise fares even before the recommendation.
The department knew that its rates were out of balance, and by increasing most fares by 4.5%, that was consistent with a lot of other recommendations that were coming to the department as a way to help increase revenues to help offset the operating costs for the department. So the department would likely move forward with this rate increase regardless. And so by announcing this now, we're giving the general public the most amount of time possible to prepare for that increase.
The analysis was conducted by Northern Economics. It recommends the Marine Highway System set rates so they can cover between 39 to 65% of operating expenses. Revenues currently cover less than one-third of the operating budget, according to the department. Woodrow says the complete rate study will be released to the legislature in February. More changes in operating costs may come after that.
The rate increase that was announced just this last week was one of the first preliminary recommendations from that analysis or from that study. The study is not complete yet, so we haven't released the full report. We'll be releasing that when we present it to the legislature this upcoming session.
The analysis suggests that rates more than 25% above average not change. Woodrow says that means about 30 fares within the system will remain unchanged, including the route between Skagway and Haines, the highest per mile rate in Southeast. Alaska is bringing back the bear to license plates. The Fairbanks Daily News Miner reports Alaskans will be able to choose license plates of blue and gold next spring that reflect state flag colors, or a new version of plates last offered in 1976 that feature a grizzly bear. The new plates feature a dark bear on a fading blue background with a silhouette of the Alaska Range. KCAW reporter Rachel Waldholtz and biologist Ellen Chenoweth are exploring the question of whether humpback whales should be taken off the endangered species list. More than 21,000 humpback whales now swim in the North Pacific, and sometime in the next few weeks, federal officials will decide whether that's enough whales to declare them no longer at risk of extinction. Like nearly all the great whales, humpbacks were heavily hunted. And one question researchers have grappled with is how many animals there were before the whaling fleets took their toll. To solve this mystery, it turns out, you have to take a trip back in time and into the secret history of Soviet whaling.
I'm Rachel Waldholtz.
And I'm Ellen Chenoweth.
So how do you figure out how many humpbacks there were before whaling? You take the number of humpbacks killed during commercial whaling, and you add that back to the current population, while taking into account things like population growth.
So all you really need is a good, complete, and accurate record of the whaling numbers, how many whales were killed.
That's Paul Wade. He's a biologist with the National Marine Mammal Laboratory.
That can be the most difficult part.
My name is Yulia Ivashenko.
Ivashenko is also a biologist at the National Marine Mammal Laboratory in Seattle.
She spent years studying the secret Soviet history of whaling.
In the North Pacific, industrial whaling was a 20th century phenomenon, and it was conducted by just a few countries, especially the Soviet Union and Japan.
And by 1946, the whaling nations had signed on to form the International Whaling Commission.
It set limits on how many whales could be taken and what kind.
And there's tons of records, but the problem is that for a long time, the records were wrong.
Under the Soviet system, every industry had targets to meet.
And that was why the Soviet whalers, they would go and try to kill as many whales as possible. Because if you kill many whales and you reach your target number, you will get a very nice bonus as a salary.
And the more whales you kill, the more bonus you get. So it was way more important to beat those targets than to abide by whaling regulations.
So in this regard, Soviet whalers just ignored everything. So they were killing any whale they wanted and in any place they wanted.
And then they'd lie to the whaling commission. Now, some scientists outside the Soviet Union suspected this was happening, but they couldn't prove it until a chance meeting in the early 90s.
So what happened was there was this American biologist, Bob Brunel, and he's talking to his Russian colleague, a guy named Alexei Yoblikov. And he's basically just complaining about how little biological data there is for right whales.
And mentioning that, Yablokov actually said that, oh, I can provide you with a lot more of biological data on the right whales. So Bob asked, actually, so how many are you talking about? Is it 5, 10, 15? He said a few hundreds.
And that's how it started to come out. It turned out that most of these boats were keeping two sets of records. The falsified version would go to the Whaling Commission, but the true catch records were also preserved. After the fall of the Soviet Union, it became possible to make those numbers public. In 1994, Yablokov published the first paper laying out the true scale of Soviet whaling, and it totally stunned people, because these numbers are huge. In 60 years of Soviet whaling in the Southern Ocean, so that's all the water south of the equator, they killed 330,000 whales, but they only reported 185,000. That's just over half. In one season in the North Pacific, the Soviet fleet caught over 15,000 sperm whales. Ivashenko says a single boat could process up to 200 whales in a day.
Just staggering, we have anything alive in the ocean left.
Soviet scientists went to heroic lengths to save the real data. Ivashenko tells the story of Dmitry Tormasov. He was a biologist with the fleet, and his job was to organize these documents called whale passports. They basically had information on every individual whale that was killed, exactly the kind of information that Bob Brownell was after for right whales. After the data was analyzed, the passports were usually destroyed, but he held on to them, storing them in his potato cellar. And because of stories like that, by the mid-2000s, scientists had managed to piece together pretty accurate records for the Southern Ocean, which is where the most intense whaling took place. But until recently, the numbers in the North Pacific were still a mystery. Then Ivashenko took a trip to Vladivostok.
So I wasn't expecting much.
Ivashenko went there to visit scientists who'd worked on the ships, and they suggested she visit a public archive.
And then I found this pile of different kinds of reports.
And those reports included true catch numbers from boats in the North Pacific, sitting there in a dusty public archive in eastern Russia.
I knew I found the treasure.
Ivashenko has been back 4 or 5 times. So far, she estimates the Soviet fleet killed 190,000 whales in the North Pacific, mostly sperm whales, and only reported 169,000. Those are smaller numbers than in the Southern Ocean, but there were fewer whales to begin with. And because the population in the North Pacific was much smaller, Ivashenko says the impact was actually larger.
In the case of humpback whales, she estimates that the Soviets took about 7,000, and most of that in the space of just 3 years.
And this is the missing piece. Literally, the math people have been waiting for Ivashenko's numbers to plug into their models. And once they run those models, we'll have a good estimate of how many humpbacks roamed the Pacific before industrial whaling. In Sitka, I'm Rachel Waldholz.
And I'm Ellen Chenoweth.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Matthew Smith in Nome, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Shady Grove Oliver in Homer, and Rachel Waldholz in Sitka. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Monica Goki. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. Over the years, Alaskans like you have donated over $10 million to nonprofit organizations benefiting everything from Alaska's youth to the arts to healthcare. You've even donated to public radio to keep quality programming alive and well in Alaska. So come on, Alaska, warm your heart by sharing your PFD. Pick, click, give. This message on Alaska Public Media comes from ExxonMobil.
From resource issues to recreational activities, APRN brings you the up-to-date information you need for life in Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.